We're joined by Tony Lea. And by the way, are you there, Tony?
I am, Phil.
Okay. Phil Conlon attended today's Labor Day, and I want him to tell you what he saw, and then I will join you both.
Okay.
Well, hi, Tony. So when I arrived to march with the main group, which is on University Avenue, I crossed City Hall Plaza, and I found that Unifor, as in previous years, had set themselves apart and aside from the main thing. And they had, from what I could see, now I was arriving before their start time, perhaps.
Yeah.
But what I could see is they had...
And so that, but they didn't really have any evidence of that other than his formal position, which when the genocide broke out, formal positions
didn't
mean that much because there were aggressive people who took command and reasonable people who were sidelined.
Tony, you there?
So, I'm here, yeah.
Okay, but there's something else on the line.
Taken by the Rwandan tried to put...
Wow. Okay, Tony, you there?
This is fun programming.
Yeah. Something happened there. There's some other Taylor report actually got superimposed on the conversation.
Well, at least we know it was good.
Well, good stuff. We know that. But
all right.
We're going to have to get Tony back.
I'm here.
Oh, yeah. You've been here the whole time?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Okay. Wait, let me jump in here. Actually, I was checking because we had a report we might have trouble with reaching our listeners. So I was looking into that. But Phil is with us, and Phil did attend today's in Toronto. And, well, Tony, let's start with your opinion. We had a military flyover, as usual, for the Labor Day. And I checked with Montreal, and they do not have, they've never seen a military flyover. And indeed, the individual I asked said he'd never heard of such a thing. And on top of that, he said they in Montreal, they celebrate, and I shouldn't say Montreal, in Quebec, they celebrate May Day, sponsored by the unions, and they have an evening march every May Day, led by the unions, and at the front of the march, they put those who are on strike. So what do you make of this? How do you explain that?
I'm pleased to hear what they said in Montreal. That's very much in keeping with the international tradition of having Labor Day on May the 1st to commemorate the fight in the United States, particularly in Chicago, for the eight-hour day and the repression and the martyrdom of the leaders of the demonstrations in Chicago that the workers of the world took up and turned into May Day, and which is celebrated by most workers around the world on May the 1st. And it's great that that is also the case in Quebec. But in most of North America, or at least most of the United States and Canada, we have this tradition of Labor Day in September, and I think that it originally was motivated as an attempt to separate workers in the United States and Canada from workers in the rest of the world and not have a common day. So it's, one of the divisions that is really important for workers to overcome, and we know there's lots of divisions, and we're all stronger when we're more united, and all demonstrating the same workers' day would be a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. You yourself, you're from at Port Elgin, which is the educational center of Unifor.
Yes.
And there was a march there in Port Elgin.
We had a Labor Day in Port Elgin for a number of years. Really spearheaded by the retired workers section of Unifor as an annual council meeting in Belgium. The labor council in the area, the Grey Bruce Labor Council, to have a Labor Day parade, and residents of Port Elgin get out their lawn chairs and sit along the main drag of Port Elgin and watch the parade go by. So we participated in that today. We had several hundred retired members of Unifor, and we also had big participation from a number of other unions in the area, teachers, QP, the high workers, members of the building trades,
And in the Toronto demonstration in March, Phil Conlon participated, the only bright spot in the whole day. I'm told that Unifor, as in years past, this is, I don't know how far back this story goes, but they gathered at City Hall Square.
Yes.
And then joined, apparently they were in the, I can't find another way to say this, the rear of the march.
There's different staging areas. I don't think that we should make too much of that, because the Toronto Parade is so big that different unions have to gather in different places and then join the march when it's their turn. And the order in the march rotates by year, so that you don't have the same union at the front every year and the same union at the back every year. So I don't think that it's unusual that Unifor waited in their staging area until it was their slot to join the march. But what is significant is that since Unifor left the CLC a number of years ago, this is the first time that joined the Labor Day parade with the rest of the labor movement.
And really, this is the first time they've done it since the division?
I believe so, yes.
That might be, to a degree, a positive sign. It comes at a time when, and we've talked about this with you in the past, is there, and as a matter of fact, the past, a week ago, I think, we spoke of this, that the hope was, expectation, when their new leadership at Unifor, and actually new leadership CLC and OFL, Metro Labor, right down the line, is that there would be a reunion of the unions. But so far, that actually hasn't happened, and there doesn't seem to be a discussion of it happening.
No, that I'm aware of, and that's the disappointing part. So Unifor marching in the parade with the rest of the labor movement definitely is development, but it needs to go further, and I think it's important that we have a united labor movement, and that would require Unifor working with the CLC and the other affiliates and solving whatever problems exist so that we can be a united labor movement again. And when Lana Payne was elected president of Unifor, she seemed to indicate at the convention, which was a year ago, that she favored that happening and that there would be discussions undertaken towards that end. But in the last few months, news of those discussions seems to have dwindled, and the occasion that seemed to be the one where it might happen, and we were told, a number of us were told, was the Unifor Canadian Council meeting in Halifax a couple of weeks ago. Nothing happened there, and the issue was not raised. And so I don't know what the status of it is, but clearly doesn't seem to be something that's going to happen in the near future.
I'm really, by the way, this is the day to, at least, it's, as long as they're going to call it Labor Day, it's definitely the time to sort of make an assessment. I noticed the Toronto Star had an editorial today that labor flexing, they didn't use the word, it's labor flexing its muscles. The only union leader quoted, by the way, is Leader Unifor. Now, we've had a strike here, and you were helping us understand the strike, Metro strike. I think it was one of the most popular and gutsy strikes, speaking of the members, one of the most underpaid groups, and one that endured COVID and got bonus pay for risking their lives. And But you are a reform advocate. You wish to see an improvement in the way things are contracts ratified and also how they're understood by members. So could you talk about what was your take on how this ended up?
Let me start by referring to an article that was in the Toronto Star by a columnist a few days ago, Bruce Arthur, and he talked about how when he was a student, he worked at a supermarket in Vancouver, and he said, this was in the 1990s, supermarket workers had good jobs. They could afford to buy homes. They could raise families. And it was, they had good hours and benefits. Mm-hmm. And he said that the pay at that time was $25 an hour, which...
We almost lost your voice when you said $25 an hour. Please continue from there.
Yes, $25 an hour. And this is the equivalent of $46 an hour today. But supermarket workers today across the country have had their wages driven down close to minimum wage. So when the Metro workers went on strike, the average part-time worker was making a little over $16 an hour, and the average full-time worker was making $22 an hour. So that's how far below what it used to be. They've been driven down by these huge companies, and we know that they're big profitable companies, Loblaws and Metro and so on. They're owned by billionaires, and they make lots of but they don't pay workers a decent wage. And that's why these workers went on strike, of course, and it should never be forgotten that they went on strike because they rejected the first offer that they were given. And they rejected it strongly. 72%,
yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I believe rejected the offer. And there needs to be an accounting, I would say, from union leadership. If they're bringing contracts to workers and recommending them and having them shot down, at some point they should recognize that there's a problem, that they are clearly out of touch with the members that they're representing. And the workers at Metro did go on strike. They went on strike for close to 5 weeks, which is, I'm sure it was a great learning experience for them. They developed, some militancy, some solidarity, and eventually they did get a better offer that they accepted. But I don't think we should overplay to the degree that union leadership likes to. They call every agreement historic, and the best ever. But
it's a 5-year deal.
Yes.
Hadn't it originally been a 4-year deal?
Yes. And this is a, I think that this diminishes the accomplishment. They were originally offered a 4-year deal with an increase of 350, I think, for the full time, and 265 for the part time. I got to emphasize that almost 80% of the workers are part time in this sector. That's another thing that's been done to drive down the wages of people, and it's really a what's known as precarious work. They are the personification of it, because if you're only given 15 or 20 hours work a week at $16 or $17 an hour, I don't know how you survive. But it was a 4-year deal that was offered.
Mm-hmm.
The second deal increased the total wages over the life of the contract modestly. But it was a 5-year deal. So when you look at it in terms of the raise per year, it wasn't actually a raise at all. It just ties them into a contract for a longer period of time. And 5 years is a very long time for a labor contract, because that puts off for 5 years when the workers can take on problems that they have and try to make improvements.
Yeah, I'm really glad to we've taken that up. And another element that you've introduced, and I've actually had people call me about it, having heard our interviews with you, is that because there is, and I noticed the Star didn't actually talk about it, but there's actually new leaderships emerging in across North America. And it, the old United Auto Workers, which Unifor was once part of, have now a very strong group of what we can call reform leaders. And if I understand you correctly, they believe in transparency and making known to the members, almost from day one, what is at issue. And that by you can use the internet as a member, and to, you can, as they say, follow along. You don't go to a meeting in a city on a day and an hour and be told by your unanimous leaders that this is the deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not a thing that the new president of UAW is doing. I think it's a terrific example of a much better way of engaging the members. He's laid out the demands that he's making of GM, Ford, and Stellantis in a very aggressive but very clear way. Very specific demands on wages and pensions and getting rid of the second tier, giving all workers a defined benefit pension, and raised the idea of a 32-hour work week for 40 hours pay. These are very bold demands, but he's laid them out in a way that the members get engaged, and obviously it's raising their expectations. And if you're a union leader and you raise the expectations of your members, then there's a lot of pressure on you to deliver. Mm-hmm. And I like that perspective. And Sean Fain was doing it again today at the Labor Day parade in Detroit, which I was happy to see.
Yeah, but boy, if we were to apply that, if the Metro workers were told, here it is, say 5 or 6 days before the meeting at least, they could sit and read it, right? And decide whether they like that or not. And also, maybe perhaps they could ask a question or two.
That's right. And that's something that has been identified as a problem in a number of areas. I know the people that I work with at General Motors in Oshawa and other people in the auto industry have been saying for years that they don't like this system where they show up at the ratification meeting, they get no information ahead of time, they get handed a glossy booklet telling them how great everything is, and they have a meeting and then they vote. And because of pressure from rank and file workers in the UAW in the U.S., they've had a better system for quite a number of years now where full collective agreement, every change that's agreed to, is published. And these days, as you mentioned, of course, it can be done online.
And why shouldn't it be? I'm amazed at how people are sort of weighed down by that old word tradition, or this is how we do things. Well, change.
Yes, there's things you definitely need for change. It's room for change. And if you look around, you can find where it's done better and say, hey, that's a better idea. Let's adopt that idea. And they have done that in the auto industry in the U.S. for a number of years now. And the members can look at and study and ask questions about the collective agreement and what's been agreed for days before they actually have to vote on it. And we've advocated that.
And to be very frank or explicit, that is not the case.
And that is not the case. It was not the case with the Metro workers. They got called to a meeting. They had to travel to that meeting from a pretty wide area because the stores that were on strike went from Milton to Orangeville to Scarborough, a pretty wide area, and they all had to get to a meeting.
One meeting. Of these dispersed workplaces.
Yeah. workers were making $16 an hour, and they don't all have cars. I think that it was not the best way to, yeah. to do
no,
things.
I would assume the ordinary union person or you know, listeners to the State Report, everybody listens, 89.5 FM, but that, you know, you go to like a Metro store, I've been honking at them for ever since the strike began, waving them, I love them, etc. But, you know, it's a kind of a lazy assumption that they're a local, but they're not a local, they're members of a local, right?
Yes, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think you pointed out that in terms of representation, they may only have one rep over 24 hours, whatever, but only one person, right?
Their collective agreement provides one union rep per store. One steward per store.
Lots of luck with that, chum.
It's not, you know, and as you know, Bill, as we've talked about it, I've been, you know, doing some research on the history of the union. And in Oshawa, when the auto workers decided to form a union and take on GM and go on strike, before they went on strike, they had 300 stewards operating in the plant of 3,700 workers. Not recognized by the company, but chosen by the workers and in place, doing the job of education and organization and taking on grievances. And one steward probably for every 12 or 15 workers. And so when they went on strike, they really had a machine that could operate. So when you accept as a union, you can only have one representative store for, you know, all the hours that the store operates, I think that you are not maximizing workers' power, which is what I think workers ought to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Phil looks like he's going to say something.
No, and
Phil's awake. Here he is.
Phil's been awake the whole time, Tony, and listening to what you said. You know, one of the things that I've always been struck by is how the employers always insist when bargaining collective agreements in limiting the number of shop stewards you can have, and that it's always a struggle to get the employers to agree to increasing the number of stewards who'd be permitted. But I find that this arrangement that you can have a supermarket with one person who's there for 8 hours a day, maybe, right, and the place is open, almost all of them now are open 15, 16 hours a day. So what happens if there's a crisis and the shop steward is not on duty? I mean, who speaks for the union when, let's say, somebody's being suspended and there's no shop steward in the store? How does that work?
I don't know. I find it hard to imagine as well. But
creativity.
You know, I think that what happens is that they just have to defer to management, and management usually gets their way. I would guess, but it's certainly not ideal. And there should be more union reps recognized. But I would raise the idea, from what I've learned, that you don't have to have management recognition. Nothing stops a union from naming people as union stewards and having them function as people who
do it anyway.
Who speak up on behalf of their fellow workers and share information and educate people and let them know what's going on. You don't have to have the management's agreement to do that. You should just do it.
That's a very good point, because when you were mentioning history, I mean, that's, they had their little militant force ready to go.
Yes.
And management didn't even know they were there.
Well, management knew they were there, by the way.
They had an idea.
But they didn't.
But you're right. I mean, it solve the problem. Don't say, oh, maybe in 5 years. No. Just go to work and solve it.
Yep.
Well, Tony, it's been great talking to you, because we've agreed that there shouldn't be warplanes on Labor Day. So there we got one. And we're celebrating that at least one great Canadian city doesn't have warplanes. And they celebrate Labor Day on May Day. Isn't that great?
That's something we should be looking at, all of them. Yeah.
We should probably share that with other Canadians. I don't know if it's a secret. Anyway, it must be a secret, and nobody knew it. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thanks, Phil.
Bye-bye. Tony's commentary is becoming more and more to the point, because it's true, that even the Toronto Star notices there's something going on out there, Mr. Jones, and you don't understand. It's not Niger, but it's close. This is the Taylor Report. I think we might have a little bite of music. Perhaps. It's up to Shay. There we go.